Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard on Utah Public Radio around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, data on jaywalking citations in Salt Lake City shows an apparent targeting of the city's homeless population. The historic Utah Theater is sold and slated for demolition, and the University of Utah football team heads to the Pac-12 championship and possibly beyond that. And those and other stories are on the docket today. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. And good morning and welcome to you, Matt.
Good morning.
Also in studio with us is reporter Tony Semerad. Hello, Tony.
Hi, everybody.
And reporter Taylor Stevens is with us as well. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And I want to begin with something today that seems almost mundane, which is the topic of jaywalking. But while you might not have any issue crossing the street where there isn't a crosswalk, reporter Taylor Stevens and her colleagues dug into the data on jaywalking citations in Salt Lake City and found that it is very much an issue of concern for some members of our community, people experiencing homelessness. And Taylor, homeless people would appear to be getting a lot more jaywalking tickets than the rest of us. Tell us about the data that you looked at and what it showed.
Yeah, so what we did is we requested all of the jaywalking citations Salt Lake City Police Department has issued for a four-year period, so from August 2015 to August 2019. And then what we did is we put all of that information, cleaned it up, put it into ArcGIS with Tony's help, glad he's here, and we tried to kind of see where is the distribution of these jaywalking tickets. And the reason that we were interested in this issue is because as we've been speaking with people experiencing homelessness throughout our coverage, we found that they have a perception or a feeling that they're being targeted for law enforcement actions that other people wouldn't experience, even if other people are doing the same thing. And jaywalking was sort of a microcosm of that. So what we ended up finding is that nearly two out of every three jaywalking tickets given within this time frame were handed out within a 16-block radius in Salt Lake City that contains Pioneer Park and the now-closed downtown emergency shelter, the Road Home. So while we don't know definitively that each of those tickets was given to a person experiencing homelessness, the distribution suggests that there is some disparate enforcement in this area.
And this is a complaint that members of the homeless community in Salt Lake City have had, is that they are being targeted. They felt like they were being targeted specifically, and they expressed this to you both in the article, but I think in advance of the work that you did. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We did hear from many people that, you know, if they avoided jaywalking at all costs to the point that they wouldn't even, you know, put a toe out of line into the street. And, you know, I think that jaywalking is something that a lot of us are guilty of. If there's no cars coming and it's faster, it's easier. It's not just something that impacts people experiencing homelessness, like, for example, something like urinating in public. That's something that more homeless people are cited for, but that makes sense because they don't have a home. Or drinking, intoxication in public, things like that. So there are kind of criminal enforcement that it makes sense that there would be disparate enforcement because of the differences. But with jaywalking, I think it's something that, you know, many people do sort of without thinking of it. And that's why we wanted to look specifically at that issue.
What do I'll ask what the consequences of, you know, for people who are homeless of getting one of these citations that is for jaywalking. What are the consequences for them if they get cited?
Yeah, so the tickets can carry fines of up to $750, and that's a maximum penalty. So a judge could choose not to do that, but a judge also could choose to levy the full fine, as well as obligations to show up in court. And that can be really difficult for someone who doesn't have a fixed address, doesn't have much money. They are able to go through homeless court, which is a Salt Lake City program that we have profiled, where you're able to do compensatory service or, you know, public service hours, treatment hours, things like that to pay off those debts. But it enters people into the criminal justice system and can lead to outstanding warrants, which the next time you get picked up can maybe mean the prospect of time in jail. So it can have a snowball effect, the kind of engagement with the law enforcement community.
Which could present a barrier to getting out of homelessness itself, right?
Right.
What do the police say about these findings, about the data that you dug into and what it appears to show?
Yeah, so police say that they don't target people who are homeless for jaywalking and that this data is a reflection of the circumstances in this area. We know that there is heavy police presence in the Rio Grande area since Operation Rio Grande. So they say, you know, there's more eyes on this, so it makes sense there would be higher enforcement. The other thing they say is that there's heavy foot traffic in the Rio Grande area. And I'll just mention that the 16 blocks that we're looking at does not include the Vivint Smart Home Arena, where I know
there's a lot of jaywalking
over there. That area is not included in our analysis. But one thing that we wanted to do, just to sort of fact check that claim of the heavy pedestrian foot traffic, is we wanted to look at the enforcement in the City Creek area, which also has a lot of foot traffic near the temple, near the mall. And so what we did is we looked at a smaller area. So in a smaller area, we looked at about 37% of all jaywalking tickets in the city were in Pioneer Park and the Road Home downtown shelter. So by comparison, in this same sort of four-block area encompassing City Creek Mall, less than 1% of all the citations issued over the past 4 years were located in that area. And so that suggests that it's not really equal to the amount of foot traffic, because we know that in the Rio Grande area, there's been a little bit less foot traffic in recent years with the kind of closing of a lot of shops in the Gateway Mall and things like that. And a lot of that traffic has gone to City Creek Mall and near the temple.
Okay. And why it is, I mean, you're looking at foot traffic being the explanation that the police are giving, or one of the explanations that the police are giving. And so if you look at basically equivalent areas in terms of foot traffic, there's a lot more people getting citations in Rio Grande than in an equivalent area, which is City Creek Center. You know, it's been a few years, but I remember at one point one of the police chiefs, and I can't remember if it was the current chief of police, Mike Brown, or Chris Burbank, who was chief of police before, he told me that the police weren't going to enforce jaywalking at all, except for in around certain areas, and those included along tracks lines, maybe in areas that seemed very dangerous. Is that something that's happening now? Or is it not? Obviously, there's enforcement happening of jaywalking.
Right, there is enforcement. And one thing that can kind of help explain this, police say, is that, you know, if they're in an area like Rio Grande that has been identified as one that needed some extra police presence, that this is sort of a way for them to apprehend people, to execute searches if needed. It's sort of seen as a policing tool. So say you see someone jaywalk and they appear to be under the influence of some kind of drugs. Do you have probable cause to search that person? So it can be used as sort of a policing tool as well, which is why I think we're still seeing some jaywalking enforcement. One other thing I want to mention that police talk to us about is they say, you know, this is a safety issue, that they enforce jaywalking because if you're out walking in the street, you're disrupting the flow of traffic, you could be hit, you could, you know, injure others, that there's sort of a safety component that they have to consider and that it's their job to maintain public safety. So we looked into that as well, just to see, you know, where are the
auto pedestrian
accidents occurring as a result of jaywalking. Specifically, we asked the Utah Department of Transportation for that data. And what we found is there was an area near the Road Home where there were, you know, identified a hot spot, but the other hot spots that were identified had very little jaywalking enforcement, only a handful of tickets. So that also suggests that police aren't tailoring their enforcement to areas that have been determined to be unsafe for pedestrians and a hot spot for jaywalking.
There's this there are these stories of police going out there. An odd thing in your article is the quote-unquote retraining of people on how to cross the street, meaning that police, according to some reports from individuals who are homeless who you all interviewed, and there are three of you who were involved in the writing of this story, that basically the police were telling them how to cross the street and making them walk through the crosswalk again if they had crossed the street before issuing them a citation. I guess I just gave away the story, but yeah, can you tell us about that?
We spoke with many people experiencing homelessness, some of them who had received citations, some who'd received warnings, and others who just knew the stories of many other folks that they knew that made them unlikely to ever want to jaywalk because they didn't want to have that interaction with police. But I think just to share another story of a person experiencing homelessness that we spoke with, Matthew Tolton, we ran into him near the Pioneer Park, and we talked to him about his experience being stopped for jaywalking, and he said that it was a Utah Highway Patrol officer who had stopped him, and the officer said that he had to pat him down. And Tolton told us that he had a banana in his pocket and that police thought it was a gun. And so they proceeded to kind of pat him down. And one thing that we spoke with advocates about is that many homeless people or people experiencing homelessness don't know their rights. And so it can kind of present some problems in that way.
What are people's rights when they're stopped for jaywalking? You wrote about, you talked just a little while ago about police using this as a method to maybe get to other criminal activity. But if a person is stopped, do they have to submit to a search if they're being cited for jaywalking?
Yeah, so one thing that we found is that the university, a former federal judge that we spoke with at the University of Utah said that courts kind of give broad deference to police when it comes to these patterns and strategies, and that being homeless is not necessarily a protected status. And so there's no kind of protection based on that status. As far as, you know, your rights for being kind of patted down, what we've heard is that if there's probable cause, then they can have a reason to execute a search. But it's a little unclear, I think, to us still as to what that needs to look like specifically.
I want to get back into the data just for a minute. We don't have all that much more time with this story, but Tony Semerad, you were involved in the sort of GIS analysis of where all of this happened. And in the article, police spokesman Greg Wilkins says that he doesn't think that just because this was near the homeless shelter that most of these citations for jaywalking were for homeless people. That's a hard thing probably to isolate for. The police weren't marking down this is a homeless person, this isn't a homeless person. But, if you just look at, I guess, the population trends on the street there, can you say anything about that? I don't know.
Well, anecdotally, I think definitely bears out. But what's, the compelling aspect of this to me is the analysis of other high volume traffic areas in town. I mean, that nexus right around City Creek, I believe, if you include the Regent Street corridor, is the highest pedestrian volume in the city on a time basis, and then abutting up against, some of the LDS churches kind of facilities there. The fact that the jaywalking citations were so very low in those areas is also kind of another factor to me.
Yeah, and Taylor.
Yeah, I just want to go back really quickly to the question that you asked before and just add that an officer needs to secure a person's consent before performing an outright search, and after that point can kind of move forward.
Got it. Okay, in terms of their rights when they're stopped. This is kind of a leading question, but in fact, I don't know if anybody can answer it, but this could be seen as a way to harass a population that property owners, don't want in their neighborhood out of their neighborhood. So you give enough of these citations that hopefully people, hopefully from the perspective of those who don't want to see homelessness in the neighborhood where they are or see it as a blight, that, this will encourage them to move along. Was there any kind of comment from police on that aspect?
Not particularly. We mostly just heard that sentiment from advocates for the homeless and people experiencing homelessness themselves.
This is a quote from Bernie Hart, who helps run a Tai Chi program for the homeless at Pioneer Park and also here on Library Square. And he says, harassing the homeless and trying to bully the homeless into doing what you want them to do is just a reflection of your inability to use nice methods or good methods to get something done. And so the question there is, are police working to help this vulnerable population, of people experiencing homelessness? Because for people with these compounding issues from citations, they probably don't think so.
Yeah, we spoke with the Department of Public Safety, and they noted that their troopers are taught that every time they stop someone for whatever reason, it's an opportunity to help someone and help connect them to services. And so they do see this as a way to sort of connect people to kind of the broader ways of helping them exit homelessness. Hmm. But as you mentioned, people experiencing homelessness certainly have a different perspective of it.
We need to head to a break here in just a minute, but Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Tribune, any comments on this, you know, before we head to a break about the reporting that was done and the data and what it shows?
It was impressive work, and it's something that shows that you do when you have reporters who are looking at an issue in detail over time, something that this team worked on for a few months, if I understand it correctly. Mm-hmm. I also thought that one of the telling things to me is the spike in jaywalking and the decline since things have started to change. Police behavior and police tactics can change depending on search situations, but I do think this is work that showed that this was targeted to a group of people, even if the police don't want to say it was.
All right, and that's Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham with the Salt Lake Tribune, and we've been hearing from reporting done by Taylor Stevens, including data from Tony Semerad, data analysis from Tony Semerad, and a variety of other reporters at the Salt Lake Tribune. If you have questions about this or any of the stories we're covering today, call us 801-355-8255. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham and reporters Tony Semerad and Taylor Stevens. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. Tony Semerad, let's turn now to a story of real estate intrigue, which might be overselling it a little bit, but it's the story of a historic piece of property in downtown Salt Lake City that has changed hands, the Utah Theater. And I want to ask you about the history of this place and the controversy around what's going to happen to it. But before we go to that, I want to ask this. What was the selling price of this piece of property?
Well, okay, this was valued, well, when the city first bought it, it was worth $5.5 million, I think, in 2010. It has declined in value, was recently appraised, I believe, over the summer at $4 million and change. And in a kind of an interesting negotiation with the city's redevelopment agency, the two development companies are going to basically get control of that property for $0.
And who, well, I would say buyer, but who is getting control of it? And this is the city that was selling it to them, right?
That is correct. There are two interesting adjacent property owners to the Utah Theater at 144 South Main. To the south is a fellow by the name of Joel LaSalle, who's a restaurateur and developer here in town, known for a couple of very interesting adaptive reuse projects where he's converted buildings into ongoing and very successful restaurants. To the north, the Kearns Buildings owner is a company called Hines, an international real estate developer, built some of the more beautiful skyscrapers in the world, and known for major projects. Those two co-developers have been in negotiations with the city since about 2017, both of them, exclusive negotiations, which basically means they talk to the city and nobody else about what happens to that particular piece of property, and those negotiations have now paid off, and they'll be taking it over.
Taking it over for $0. Why the exclusivity again? Just because they were adjacent property owners?
Well, this whole story, I think, has kind of highlighted some very major differences between what we call the redevelopment agency, which is kind of this municipal agency tucked inside city government and government as we know it in general. The redevelopment agency plays by somewhat different rules when it comes to negotiating on these kinds of things. It owns a bunch of property around town. Its goal, of course, is urban renewal and bringing in affordable housing and actually historic preservation as part of its mission, too. And in contrast to the city, it kind of wheels and deals in a somewhat different way when it comes to these transactions in town. And I think some of the rules it plays by have led to these accusations of a lack of of transparency on this particular issue.
Right, but there's and some of the rules that they play by include the idea that if you are an adjacent property owner to a piece of property, you can negotiate for without there being any kind of bidding process. You can get that exclusivity in the contract.
Yeah, right? That's correct. And you know, it's important to remember the RDA Redevelopment Agency owns a lot of little lots all around town and is often kind of interested in spurring development and kind of breaking through, prior obstacles. And so it's in a position of being interested in cutting deals with adjacent property owners when it can't get a property developed in some other way. So this has been an important tool in the past, but I think it's kind of highlighted some of the shortcomings of their process in terms of transparency this time.
Let's talk about what this place is. I mean, it's been sitting there on Main Street vacant for quite a long time. It is, as we said, an historic theater. What is its history?
It was originally built as part of the Pantages chain, kind of 1919 era is when it opened. It was a showcase in the sort of post-vaudeville era, and oldsters in town will can regale you with anecdotes of seeing Bob Hope and Babe Ruth and some of the Abbott and Costello and some of the big acts in the day. It served that purpose pretty much up until about the 30s and then was converted into a movie house. And then in the 70s, there was a fairly critical kind of structural change made to the structure to kind of chop off the upper bowl and make that more suited to a movie theater that did, in the end, some pretty sort of fatal structural changes to it and damaged its sort of historic its historic value in this whole equation.
Okay, and so there are there are some people who really don't want to see it erased from our downtown. I guess people who are concerned about historic preservation and, actually hold that thought for a second because there is a phone call here from someone who wants to comment on the story of the Utah Theater, and this is David in Salt Lake City. And David, what's your comment on the historic Utah Theater and what's happening here?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Well, there's so much about it. I'm just so disgusted with the mayor and spineless city council with this corporate welfare. They've had 4 years of secret negotiations with these developers, multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporations that they're giving this away for free. Now they'll try to say, they say they're going to build a mid-block walkway, which there actually is not a commitment to. There's an encouragement to think about it, as well as a commitment or an encouragement to think about making a park. They say they want a park in downtown, like the Galvin Center, less than a block away from the Utah Theater. It's just absolutely disgusting. They bought it in 2009 for $9 million. In perspective, that was the height of the recession, bottom of the real estate market. We're now at the top of a bubble in the real estate market. This is prime downtown real estate. They're giving away for free.
David, can I ask?
Public process, without a competitive bid process, without even going, it just reeks on so many different levels. And I want to congratulate Council District 4, Anna, I can't remember her last name.
Valdemoros.
And there was one other City Council district, the city council person who was appalled at this.
David, can I just
others kowtowed and thanks.
Can I ask?
Yes.
I got a question for you, which is: do you want to see it preserved as a historic theater? Is that's what you would like to see?
Absolutely. Okay. This is our last movie palace in Salt Lake City. Can you imagine the benefit, the financial benefit, if say Sundance would, I believe, with the Tiffany skylight there, which alone is valued at millions of dollars.
Hey, David, I'm gonna get some responses here from Tony Semerat, our reporter, and thank you for your call and for your concern, and we will address some of the issues you've brought up here, and thanks for listening and for calling.
I appreciate it. The RDA, if you go to their website, the so-called the stated goals were all violated here.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just disgusting.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thanks for the call. Tony Semmer had a couple of points. One on the sales price, which he said in 2009 was $9 million. Is that accurate?
I think the city bought it for $5.5 million. But you know, David raises a lot of sort of broader concerns that others have raised about this, and we should put some numbers to this negotiated sort of land discount. That $4 million that the city might have been able to sell that piece of property for, in exchange for that, it's writing in some covenants that will cover the land that will guarantee a considerable amount of affordable housing in the developers who are proposing to build a skyscraper there. It would have about 300 apartments. About a tenth of those, about 30 apartments, would be kept affordable under this deal. And that the parlance is that deal runs with the land. That is, anybody that builds on that site, whether it's these developers or others, would have to include that affordable housing. This mid-block walkway, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, just quickly, the exact number of affordable units in there?
It's about 30.
Okay, thanks.
And they would be somewhat affordable. They're not deeply affordable. This would be for people making between 60 and 80% of the median wage.
And then you're going to this mid-block walkway. One of his statements was that there's no actual contract saying this has to happen or nothing about a park.
Well, in fact, there is. The contract that the mayor signed regarding the sale would require the affordable housing. It would require the mid-block walkway, and again, that be about 15 foot wide, about 200 feet into the block. It doesn't really cut all the way through the block, which is what the city would like, but it would lead to a proposal for a park there, which isn't required in the current sales deal, but. And then the third requirement would be that pieces of the theater be used in the future development, and those are binding in the sales agreement. Those things will have to happen.
The walkway, the affordable housing, and reusing
some of the historical items. The park is a discretionary item. That's a kind of a wanna part of the list, not a requirement of the list. But you know, the bottom line is, as David mentions, there are members of the public that just don't feel that the city is getting enough, really, for this write down of the land to zero.
And so there are historic preservationists. So there's sort of a movement afoot, even a what's the word for it? An initiative, a petition,
right,
to try and stop this from happening.
Yeah, a downtown business owner, Pete Ashdown, has sort of marshaled this online campaign to save the theater, something like 4,000 signatures. There's a pretty avid constituency for this facility.
I should disclose that he is an underwriter with KCPW through his business X Mission. This deal was inked by, as you said, the current but outgoing mayor, Jackie Biskupski. You know, what does she say about this being her preference for what happens?
Well, the RDA has vetted this for easily, you know, 4 or 5 years, looked at a number of ways to reuse it. The notion of a single screen movie theater was just not thought to be economically viable in this environment. You know, most of the movie theaters have multiple screens. And you know, the city for its account really exhausted all of the options and was coming up with a price tag upwards of $60 million. The Mayor Biskupski's calculation was that the voters have recently approved several tax measures for other purposes, the Funding Our Future measure and the $89 million road bond, and that, you know, voters would be reluctant for an additional sort of debt issuance of about $30 million or something like that to save the theater. So it was a political calculation for her, just in terms of not wanting to go back to the voters to ask for more money. Philanthropic donors have been very generous with the Eccles Theater, and they were thought to not really be willing to kind of pony up additional money for Utah Theater. So, you know,
it's interesting because just between the comparison there is that the Eccles Theater is a brand new theater. This is a very old theater. And I mean, I wonder if it would be different facets of fundraise of the community coming forward to fundraise. Maybe not. Maybe there's only so deep a pool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure just how exhausted that discussion really was, you know. But that was the mayor's sort of calculation.
And then the incoming mayor is currently a city council member, Erin Mendenhall. She voted on this proposal this week. David mentioned that there were two city council members who voted against this deal that that transferred ownership of this property. How did Erin Mendenhall vote?
She voted for it, and she has told the Tribune that after participating in the debate for since she's been on the council since 2013, that she trusted the mayor to kind of figure all this out and dispose of the property in the best interests of city residents. Anna Valdemoros, whose district includes the theater, it didn't really feel like the city was getting enough in terms of a guarantee of a downtown park. That's something that she's been interesting, and she had some questions about this deal. And Andrew Johnson, I think his reservations had to do with the valuation and just the idea of taking the property to zero. But there was strong support for this particularly among council members that had watched this under the Becker administration and watched the Biskupski administration kind of try to figure it out too. They're ready to do this deal.
Have you seen this space, Tony? Have you been inside of it?
I was. I toured it in 2015, just as the Becker administration was going out. It definitely has the same, aspects of the same era of its, neoclassical glory back in the day. But it has suffered extensive water damage, and this structural modification to make it a movie theater really devalued it in terms of its historical authenticity. The plaster features on the walls are especially subject to water damage, and they've suffered. I mean, it's a beautiful old building, it is really a relic of the past.
What about this? Sorry, just this is one thing that I want to ask about before we actually have to move on to other stories. But this Tiffany skylight that David mentioned and is in the article, what does that look like?
It's very dramatic. It's one of the pieces that the sales deal would require the developers to preserve. It's a very dramatic Tiffany skylight. There's other features in there too that deserve saving. Hmm.
What else do we need to know before we head to other stories here? Where does this go from here?
Well, the co-developers go into a period of due diligence where they're going to study this thing, maybe 6 to 9 months, something like that. The city has final review over the development plan, which is an important pinch point. The RDA is going to be able to kind of review in pretty granular detail what this skyscraper is going to look like. So there's going to be a lot of purview from here on out.
Okay, that's real estate reporter Tony Semerab with the Salt Lake Tribune. And actually, we're going to head to another break in the show. And when we come back, we will talk about the story of a substitute teacher who was fired after some comments she made during class. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be back in a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Tony Semerad, and Taylor Stevens. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Matt Canham, senior managing editor, patiently waiting in the wings here. The Tribune covered a story about a substitute teacher who made first local and then national and international headlines for a lecture that she gave to her students that wasn't on the lesson plan. Matt, this happened in advance of Thanksgiving, and students were talking about what they were thankful for. What school, what class, meaning what age group of kids, right. And what happened?
This was in Deerfield Elementary School in Cedar Hills, which is in the northern part of Utah County, and this is a class of fifth graders. So this substitute teacher, she asked the students what they were thankful for, and kids went around, and kids this age, they were thankful for eating turkey and mashed potatoes. They are thankful for their dog, one girl said. And then this boy said that he was thankful that his two dads were about to adopt him, which is a touching moment, except for this substitute teacher didn't think so. She lectured the students on how she believed homosexuality is a wrong, that two men living together is a sin, and that this boy should not be thankful for being in that household. Now, this is a public school. This is clearly out of line. Three of the girls in that class knew that. tried to get the substitute to stop. And when she continued to talk about it, they left the class, got the principal, and the principal also did the right thing. This principal escorted the substitute out of the school immediately. The substitute continued to argue that what she was saying was right and these students need to know about it as she was told to leave. This is pretty outrageous behavior. And one of the dads went to social media, who has, he has a quite a significant following, and posted a video about it, which is how our reporter Courtney Tanner found out about this story, which we posted. And as you said, it went everywhere.
Right. Did the parents, you know, both of the parents, or at least one of the dads, made some statements afterwards, not just on social media, but to Courtney and in reporting about how traumatic this was, basically, or, you know, basically how unfair this was for her, for their son, his son.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, the son at first didn't want to come forward or cause any waves or, you know, cause a problem for the substitute. Can you talk about that? And it also has to do with his adoption.
Right. So this boy felt that he was being blamed for his family relationship and that it was his fault that this interaction went off because he's the one that brought up the topic. This boy has been through two failed adoptions. His adoption is expected to go through December 19th, I believe. We can't name him because you can't publicly name a kid in like social media or in other
sure.
aspects if you're in the process of adopting them. And so he didn't want to get in the way of it. It was an emotional thing for these parents, obviously. But it's also nice to see the outpouring of support for this kid in this community in Utah County, as well as for the girls who did the right thing.
Right.
The principal's pretty proud of that.
Right. The principal lauded the girls and the community came forward and also sort of showered them with complimentary, you know, with compliments. And then also there was some outpouring from the neighborhood where these people live, that where the family lives, of the boy in question and his two dads. They came and decorated the house.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
It's a really nice story. And I think part of the reason this story was as read as it was is that not only was there an outrage factor, but it's heartwarming to see the right thing happen, which doesn't always happen in these circumstances, especially this quickly, that classmates came to this boy's defense, that the school came to this boy's defense. That's nice. And the company that hires the substitute,
right.
which is Kelly Services, it's a temp agency that has contracts throughout this country when it comes to substitute teaching, also said that they're not going to stand for this as well. After it took him a day to do an investigation, they decided this person's not going to be a substitute anymore.
And they let them go. Yeah. You know, one part of this also is how substitutes are hired, and there's been some maybe new scrutiny on that process, the fact that there aren't a lot of rules or regulations for substitute teachers in Utah. I mean, there's a background check necessary, but maybe not all that much training. Is that right?
Yes. Kelly Services says they do training on appropriate classroom behavior, techniques and how to interact with students. They do an interview and a background check, but none of that's in state rules. Essentially, the only thing in state rules is that if a teacher has lost that teacher's license for misconduct, that teacher can't be a substitute in the future. But outside of that, you don't have to have any sort of qualifications to be in a classroom.
Hmm. You know, now the boy is waiting for this adoption to be finalized, but for his two dads, that's sort of waiting to happen. There's some final process there.
Yes, I mean, an adoption is a complicated process. I've actually had some friends who've gone through this, and it gets to the point where you just have that last hearing where all the paperwork's ready to go. That's the stage. This is a done deal. They're just minutes away.
I'm going to have to cut you off there because I'm realizing we're nearly out of time. To save time for a final segment that we have with a sports reporter, Kurt Cragthorpe, about the University of Utah, we need to turn now to our final segment, Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Taylor Stevens, are you ready with a story?
Sure. I want to highlight a piece from my colleague Scott Pierce. He has been reporting on the closure this week of the Utah Repertory Theater Company, which closed its doors Tuesday after its set was vandalized Saturday. There were some allegations about the group's working conditions. For full details, you can look at the story on sltrip.com.
It's a pretty remarkable story. And the end of a company because of that protest. Tony Semmered, your pick for underplayed story.
So I'm going to highlight a story by colleague Brian Maffley about a $1.5 billion investment by Kennecott into its Bingham mine operations, supposed to extend the life of the mine out till 2032. Right now, the county is involved in a very detailed planning effort. Kennecott owns about 70% of the undeveloped land in the county right now. This idea of pushing the life of the mine out is going to have big impact on land use on the west side.
From an original departure date of 2026
That's correct.
To 2032.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
The Sagato Bakery and Cafe in Midvale is raising money for Samoa, which has been hit with a horrible measles outbreak. At least 60 people have died. They have shut down the entire island. We have a lot of connections to the Polynesian community here, and so they're raising not just money but medical supplies. So you can look that story up. Peyton Harkins wrote it last night, and I donated some masks. It's pretty easy to do, so something to check out.
Awesome. Check that out at sltrib.com, as well as all of the stories that we've been covering. I'm going to forego my underplayed story of the week in the interest of time and say Matt Canham, Tony Semmered, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To close out the show today, we're going to turn to a conversation that I have with University of Utah athletics reporter Kurt Cragthorpe. He's headed to Santa Clara to see the Utes play in the Pac-12 championship. Before he left, I sat down with him to talk about tonight's game and about what might come next for the Utes. Kurt Cragthorpe, Salt Lake Tribune, University of Utah athletics reporter. Thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
So the number 5 Utes are playing in the conference championship tonight against Oregon. I want to get to the matchup in just a second, but aside from the Pac-12 championship itself, there's this looming background, the semifinals, the college football playoffs. If Utah beats Oregon, are they a shoe-in for those playoffs, Kurt?
They're not a shoe-in. It's a very intriguing process of the college football playoff selection committee. They've done rankings throughout the month of November and into December every Tuesday, and Utah has gradually moved up every week. And now is number 5, as you say, poised to break into the top 4 and be picked for the semifinals. But obviously, the Utes have to win Friday night to become 12-1 and enhance their credentials. And then they need some things to go their way on Saturday and some other conference championship games around the country, notably number 4 Georgia having to lose to number 2 LSU. So that would be the game that Ute fans would watch very closely.
Right, definitely. Is that the only variable that LSU, I mean, there's probably others, aren't there, that could affect our chances of getting into the playoffs?
Yeah, the one that everybody's talking about right now is Oklahoma at number 6 playing number 7 Baylor, on the logic that win would be more valuable than Utah beating number 13 Oregon, and therefore the committee could vault Oklahoma over Utah. So that's where you get into this further issue of how much you win by or how good you look in the process. And so that applies to both Utah and Oklahoma this weekend.
I mean, does that mean that the teams are going to be running up the numbers as much as they possibly can?
Well, to the extent that they can, it's not like they're playing bad teams. So I don't see that happening in either case. Utah-Oregon should be a very competitive contest, and Oklahoma had to work like crazy to beat Baylor in their regular season meeting. So to that point, it would be impressive if either team was able to do that.
Got it. Okay, so the matchup is so close that maybe there's not even a chance of running up the numbers. This is going to sound a little cynical, but let's say that everything does go according to plan and those wins happen the way that we want them to happen and Utah beats Oregon. Could Utah get snubbed by the committee just for being Utah? I'm thinking about ad buys, the number of people watching here versus in other parts.
Yeah, that's a very valid question. And on the scale from naive to cynical, I come a little closer to naive, actually. So I'd like to believe that wouldn't happen, but in a real world, it is possible. And that's what a lot of people outside of the committee are talking about this week, that Oklahoma is a much bigger brand name than Utah, for example. And it would be more intriguing for TV viewers in name a place in the country to watch Oklahoma play Ohio State than Utah. But I really believe that college football is such a marketable product that it's risen above that level, particularly when the other 3 teams would be LSU, Clemson, in Ohio State that have this incredible following. I can't believe people would say, no, I'm not going to watch Utah play one of those teams.
Right. I mean, I would sure watch. I can't wait to watch. Kurt, if Utah wins tonight, we're almost basically guaranteed a slot in the Rose Bowl, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the whole premise of winning the Pac-12 championship, is that you do advance to the Rose Bowl. And that's what people have been talking about since 2010, ever since Utah joined the league, and what a incredible opportunity that would be.
Right.
But in the meantime, the college football playoff has been invented to where there are these four teams having a chance for the national championship. And so as this season has evolved and Utah climbed in those rankings we've talked about, people have kind of put themselves in a position where the Rose Bowl will feel like a letdown, which is kind of crazy to think about, but that's kind of the nature of it. And the other weird part is that Oregon knows that if they win the game, they will go to the Rose Bowl. They also then would hope that Utah got in the playoff if they lose to the Utes, because then Oregon would fill the spot for the Pac-12 in the Rose Bowl. So it's some weird things in play. But the bottom line is there's so much at stake tonight, because Utah could fall to a bowl like the Alamo Bowl in San Antonio that would be a complete letdown, much less the Rose Bowl.
Right. By the way, when will we know who is advancing to the playoffs, to the semifinals?
Yeah, officially Sunday morning. There will be a big selection show naming those top four teams. So we'll have a pretty good idea as of Saturday night, but officially Sunday morning.
Okay, I have just a couple more questions. One is, when was the last time Utah was ranked as well as they are ranked now?
Yeah, there was a moment during the 2015 season when Utah was 6-0 and ranked number 3. That was actually before they came out with any playoff rankings, but that was in the AP poll. They were number 3. And then that season kind of didn't totally fall apart, but ended up being a little disappointed because the Utes lost 3 games that year. So to be this far along, the only comparison you can come up with would be the undefeated seasons of 2004 and 2008. But that was in the Mountain West era, and there was no opportunity for Utah to get close to the national championship game, which was just, in essence, a two-team playoff in those days.
Right. How the tides have turned. For all of this that we're talking about, which is kind of speculative, we have to first win tonight. What does this matchup look like? I know the Utes are favored. How much are they favored by? And what's this game going to look like, Kurt?
Yeah, I think they're favored by about 5 points. But what's interesting is this whole week has evolved, is people have kind of just looked past Friday thinking about all these other things that we've talked about. And I'm trying to remind people that this is going to be a very difficult game. It is interesting that last year Utah played Oregon at Rice-Eccles Stadium in November, and it was right after quarterback Tyler Huntley and running back Zach Moss had been injured. And they got this incredible fill-in performances from Jason Shelley and Armon Schein and beat the Ducks with a fourth quarter rally. And so people are saying, okay, if we can beat them with those guys, certainly we can beat them with the main guys. But I think this matchup is very difficult. If you look at a couple of common opponents, you can drive yourself crazy or prove any point you want by kind of comparing scores. But two things come to mind. One is that each team had almost the exact kind of game against Washington in Seattle, rallying in the fourth quarter to win. And then you look at Utah's only loss coming to USC, a team that Oregon went to Los Angeles and beat 56-24. The further irony being that because Utah lost to USC, they needed USC to lose to Oregon.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be in this game. That's what's kind of funny about it. But I really think it's an excellent matchup. Oregon has probably the best offensive line in the country. Utah may have the best defensive line. Oregon has an excellent quarterback, Justin Herbert, who came into the season as a Heisman Trophy candidate. Utah's Tyler Huntley has risen to that level or above this year. So I think in terms of talent, they really line up comparably. And so I expect it to be a great game. The one huge variable is the weather. It's supposed to be a 100% chance of rain tonight in Santa Clara on a grass field. So we'll see how all that plays into it. But it really should be a terrific, even game.
All right, we're looking for some mutters in the rain, I
Absolutely.
Guess.
Absolutely.
What time's kickoff?
It's 6 o'clock Mountain Time.
Okay, and you'll be there watching it. Kurt Cragthorpe with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks so much for laying this out for us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
And again, that's Salt Lake Tribune University of Utah athletics reporter Kurt Cragthorpe wrapping up this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his work on the show and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. We appreciate your tuning in. Have a great weekend and go Utah.